will be a movie or a novel or a lived example. And then they'll be searching for a language to make sense of that, to make sense of their gut instinct. That's what these arguments are about. Or you'll have a college kid who goes off to college, has the right instincts, and then encounters arguments from the other side and wants to know, to be intellectually respectable, to be a serious man or woman, do I need to change my mind on these things? And the only response in that case will be at the same level, reasons and arguments. More broadly, I think it's crucial for the life of the church. It's very easy to think that at least within the church, yeah, maybe for tactical reasons outside the church, we need kind of natural law or other general arguments, but you know, within the church, we can make do with the Bible. And of course, the Bible is the inspired word of God. Nothing you read by a philosopher is going to be anything like that. But I think reason is also a God-given gift. It's also a source of knowledge. And the two work together beautifully in lots of ways. For one thing, you want reason to be able to fully understand revelation and to be able to extend it and apply it to new circumstances. So the good book says, thou shalt not kill. That is a quote I have word for word. And somehow, thank you. And somehow we get from that to the splendid refinement of just war theory. Or to our explanations of the right of self-defense, lethal self-defense included. How do we bridge that gap? It's the process of absorbing and understanding and unpacking the contents of Revelation. And all those things are about using our natural human reason, using the gift of philosophy to appreciate more deeply the gift of faith. Also for new circumstances, there are some questions that Paul couldn't have a specific account of in his letters because they just weren't there yet, not in the form that we have them today. The good book says, be fruitful and multiply. It says, love your neighbor as yourself. All right, now what about artificial reproductive technologies? Is that one way of being fruitful and multiplying that makes sense of that commandment? Is it one way that fully respects the second one of loving your neighbor as yourself? Or is there a tension between them? Is there some kind of inequality towards the child in trying to be fruitful and multiplying in this particular way? For that, you need arguments. You need to think things over. You need reason and philosophy. Even our Lord himself displays this. All right? There was a point where our Lord was asked about a particular teaching of Revelation, and the way he answered it, the way he unpacked it for his questioner, was to appeal to reason, to give the person a thought experiment. I'm talking about the Good Samaritan. That's the parable of the Good Samaritan. What was the context? Jesus saying, you know, the Leviticus command to love your neighbor as yourself. And some loser, is a schmuck, a lawyer actually, says, okay, all right. Yeah, I love my neighbor, but who's my neighbor? Huh? And how does our Lord reply? Does he point to another part of the scriptures? No. He says, let me tell you a story. You tell me who was neighbor to the man who fell to the hands of robbers. He's appealing to reason in the lawyer. Even the lawyer has the gift of reason. He's appealing to reason in the lawyer to unpack Revelation. So we can do the same. We can do the same with the idea of one flesh union. What does that mean? Like, well, let me tell you a story. Let me give you an analogy. Union within a person. Let me ask you what love, what romantic love seeks. Let's unpack that idea using reason. It's also crucial for defending Revelation, of course, with people who don't already accept it. They want to know, is one flesh union just a kind of gerrymandered concept that was designed to exclude the loves of a hapless few? Or is it something that really corresponds to human nature? For that kind of challenge, you can't just point to another part of Revelation, because that's the whole question. And here's the other thing. This is probably the most easily missed point. Sometimes you need philosophy even to understand what Revelation is saying, and Revelation proves it. So think about this fact. When God was looking for an image, if we can anthropomorphize for a second, when God was looking for an image to get across to us the kind of union he wants with his people, the kind of union Christ would have with the church, he pointed to a natural institution, marriage. He said, they know something about marriage, so I'll say it's like that. Now, of course, he's the one who created marriage in the first place, so it wasn't just like a second thought that he had. This was all by design. But it does show that that revelation itself depends on the idea that we can know some things by reason. So when God says that his union with his people is like a marriage, we can understand why idolatry is like adultery. It's an infidelity to the beloved. When God says he wants an old and then a new covenant with his people, and we think about the covenant of marriage, where it's not just an exchange of goods and services, but whole people, a total union of persons. We can understand that. Yeah, when within marriage, the two become one, and so what you do for yourself, you do for the other. You get a whole new set of reasons for doing everything you do. And that's why even the covenant of one body and one spirit, one flesh in Christ, what we do for the least of our brethren, we do for him. His good is at stake in theirs. Or everything that we do for ourselves, we can also do as unto the Lord, as St. Paul says. We understand the covenantal union of marriage, giving us a whole new set of reasons for everything we do, so we can understand the new covenant, giving us a set of supernatural reasons for everything we do. So the more you spell out what marriage is using reason, the more you'll even understand what Revelation is saying. And again, we have not just our Lord's example, we have St. Paul's example at the Areopagus, appealing to what people thought they knew about the nameless, the unknown God. We have him in Acts 17. He's there, he's going to defend a view you can't just defend by reason, which is that Christ rose from the dead and that there is a bodily resurrection. You have to have witnesses for that. And yet he begins by doing what? By arguing in the marketplace with the philosophers, with the Stoics and Epicureans. So we have in the New Testament the example of relying on reason to unpack Revelation. So how do we do it? How do we do it, especially on these issues where it is so difficult to get a hearing and so difficult to keep the temperature moderate? I think the most important thing, if you remember one thing from everything I say, let it be this. Tone above all. Tone matters more than anything. And if you doubt that, think in your own case. Think about a big debate you had with a friend or a relative more than, let's say, 3 months ago. All right. Could have been abortion, could have been marriage. Now think, how many of their substantive points do you remember? Maybe one or two. One thing stuck out at you. It was the toughest to respond to, or the easiest to respond to. You felt like you dominated that point. All right, fine. But probably not too many. On the other hand, do you remember how you think they felt about you and how they felt about the issue? What their tone was, what their tone told you about their motives and their motivations, of course. And that's the last thing you will forget about that conversation. I think that's true of all these conversations. And as you'll see, I think any of these efforts to persuade people has to be a long-term project. And it can't be that unless you have the right tone and approach. And probably, even in my own case, in very short-term context, I see that in action. Somebody asked me during the lunch, you know, what's your most hostile audience been? And I think it was, I had to give a talk at Columbia Law School. So it was actually open to anyone in Manhattan who wanted to come, but it was mainly Columbia students who came, and there were plans for protests ahead of time and threats of this and that, and Facebook groups designed to figure out how to, you know, to moon me or to protest me or to glitter bomb me. Did you know that was a thing, by the way? And I went in, and it was kind of exciting, actually. There were plainclothes police everywhere, and they took me aside and they gave me a game plan and an escape route in case something happened, right? So I'm kind of loving this. And I got up to the front of the room, and I realized there was a decision to make. Because you could tell, even by the way people were sitting, that they just had contempt for me. They sort of like slinking in their seats, like smirking, waiting to catch me, to embarrass me, to humiliate me. And the choice was, what tone will I take? And the second most important thing to say is that a tone of confidence and cheer is the toughest thing to have on these issues and the most important above all. So I got up to the podium and I said, as I often do at these very hostile audiences, I just smiled real big, as far as my teeth can show. And I said, I am thrilled to be here. And you can already see this puzzlement on their faces. And I said, I know that almost every one of you thinks that my view is not just wrong, but stupided or bigoted or both. And actually, I think it's the superior view in terms of reasons. I'm going to give you my arguments. I'm going to show you deep contradictions in your own view. And I want you to prove me wrong in Q&A. Are you ready? Everything changes. Everybody's posture goes up. They're interested. They're engaged. They want to hear what you have to say. You just called their bluff. The confidence, the overconfidence on the other side is very often a very thinly masked insecurity and a kind of groupthink. It's like, well, if we all play tough together, we can intimidate them. I don't think it's always conscious that way, but it's real. And if you call the bluff, you just with a smile and very simply and very confidently. I mean, after all, you think you've got good news for them. You think you have a view that's good for them, good for society, good for the common good. So act like it. Show it to them in the way that you talk and in your cheer. I had another context of this. It's all about expectations. So I was, after my first debate, I think, I had to miss a law school class for it. And when I came back, at the next law school class of this course, a friend said, oh, we miss you on Thursday. I said, yeah. She said, well, where were you? I said, I was at a debate. And she said, on what? I said, marriage. She said, what aspect? Oh, I said, whether to recognize same-sex relationships as marriages. And she said in this kind of like, oh, I know what you're going to say, but I have to ask it anyway. Like, what side were you on? Expecting we were all on the right side. And I paused, and I just thought, all right, go cheerful and confident. So I said, I'm against. And she said, she paused. She was just shocked. She was like, she searched, and she searched. And then all of a sudden, her face lit up, and she said, oh, was it one of those debates where you go and they assign you a position? Like, and I had another decision point. And I said, no. And it was amazing. Even there, she immediately turned. And what would have been a posture of dismissal and contempt for the other side, for those people's views over there, quickly became one of engaged curiosity. They're intrigued. The dividing line between those two attitudes is very thin. And you have to exploit it by being cheerful and confident. The other thing to be is honest. We often think that when the cause is sacred, as these causes are, we have to make it look like every single thought you could ever have about the argument points in our direction. And nothing, there's no real motivation for the other view. Of course, that's not true. These people have decent motivations in many cases. And in some cases, there are good effects to the changes they want. It's just that on balance, the effects are worse for the common good. So if somebody says to you, well, isn't it better for the kid in the same-sex parented household to get a tax break through education if it's connected to the whatever? Say, yeah, of course. If you just zoom in on that household, it's not like the money stops being useful, the currency drops because it enters a same-sex zone or something. Of course, money is useful no matter what the parented household is. They say to you, well, wouldn't it be nice to fight bigotry and to fight bullying? And to encourage the idea that these people matter too. Of course. And if that's the lesson some people will take from redefining marriage, then that's one good thing that will come out of redefining marriage. But, on balance, for these reasons, I think not. In that particular case, I think, as I started to allude to earlier, it's just, if we use our marriage law, we change its public purpose. We say, now we're using it mainly to express who counts. Well, that's good for the people who get included, but it's going to be bad overall. Because it's going to reinforce the idea that people who remain unmarried for whatever reason count for even less. We can fight bullying and we can fight bigotry in other ways. So you begin to acknowledge the points that deserve acknowledgement. You have nothing to fear from the truth. So if a point is true, you can take it on, and there won't be some kind of decisive loss in doing so. You just always have to make clear the bigger picture and why you still fall on the side that you do. You also have to be proactive. You have to anticipate their objections. That conversation with them should not be the first time you hear any of the points they make. And it doesn't have to be. You have to spend just 10 minutes off on the Huffington Post or the Daily Kos or the New York Times or in a college or a university before you figure out everything they have to say. I can tell you, I've been to about, I don't know, like over 100 lectures and debates on this issue. There are about 10 points that just come up over and over and over. I hear the question, and in the first three words, I know what my answer is going to be. I just have to pull out a file. It's like, which one am I going to give this time? All right, this stuff is not that complicated, and you have to do your homework ahead of time. And either looking up the arguments or looking at treatments of the arguments, the book, we tried to cover all the objections we had heard in the What is Marriage book. You get a slightly more updated and more sort of like popular packaging for it in Ryan's book, Truth Overruled. And you ask people. It's very important, I think, sometimes just to talk to somebody on the other side of a particular issue, only listening. Just ask them questions about their own view and say, tell them that. Tell them, I don't want to have a fight with you. I don't even want to make any points in this conversation. I just want to learn where you're coming from. And figuring out the language that they use. It's very, very effective also for starting a healthy conversation with them. The other thing you want to do is, when you anticipate their objections, do it in a way that's not antagonistic. So I like to frame things so that they feel like if they come to agree with me at the end of this conversation or at the end of this long-term exchange back and forth over months, they are not giving in, they're joining in. They're not giving in, they're joining in. Don't let pride be an issue for them, an obstacle for them. How do you do that? Well, you don't say things like, well, and then you guys have this ridiculous objection, but that I can blow out of the water this way. You say, no, yeah, I totally see that. Yeah, this is something that really weighs on people a lot, and I've thought about this a lot myself. And here's how I thought about it, whatever the objection is. And you want to be practiced. You have to practice having the words come out of your mouth. There is no substitute to doing that. It's absolutely crucial. Now, all right, so those are very simple general points about having any of these conversations and just setting the stage for them in tone. Well, what about tactics? What about more specific things? So I think one thing is, you're going to have to deal, in these debates in particular, you have to deal with the fact that you're at a disadvantage. There's no two ways about it. You're at a disadvantage because you're defending a view that is both traditional and unpopular. Am I still on? All right, I faded out for a second. Traditional and unpopular. Why is that a disadvantage? Well, if it's traditional, it's been the background for a long time. And like we said in the last session, it can be hard. You're at bedrock. You're kind of scraping at the bottom of the barrel now. You're trying to defend the things that you would use as premises in other arguments. So it can be hard to do. But it's also unpopular. And because it's unpopular, there will be double standards all over the place. What do I mean by that? I mean that people will use bad arguments. Arguments that they would never accept in any other context. Because they can get away with it. Because they can get away with it. It's clear on the life issues. They say, well, you know, it could be a huge economic constraint. It can ruin a mother or her boyfriend and the girl's life plans and dreams and desires. All of that can start being true of a two-year-old as well as an unborn child. Nobody would take that as an argument to begin, like, well, should we allow exposing your infants like they did in the Roman Empire? So they accept an economic argument against the unborn that they would never accept against anybody else. But it certainly happens. It certainly happens in the marriage debate. I was once debating a professor of politics at Princeton. Now, usually I don't do stuff on home turf because I just have a general rule. I just want a kind of division between work and home. And, you know, if somebody says the wrong thing or whatever, I'll have to deal with it next week, whereas at any other law school, I can just walk away, and I'll never see them again. But this one time, I gave in, all right? And it was a debate with a liberal law liberal professor of politics, very distinguished guy, who has defended a kind of conservative case for same-sex marriage. It's like, well, it extends family values and stability and so on. We can talk about that particular argument in Q&A. But the question for the debate was, will this lead to polyamory, to the legal recognition of multiple partner relationships? That was it. That was the specific point. So I got up and I said, well, I just don't see any argument that the good professor has that wouldn't apply to these homes. And we talked about that a little bit in the first session. They don't want to be stigmatized. They don't want their kids stigmatized. They want to present to the world as one. They want all three names on the deed, on the tax filing. You know, what argument is there that doesn't apply? And then I said, and this isn't just my abstract point. It's not conservative scaremongering. There are lots of people advocating for this who say, you've worried about the LGBT marriage equality. Now worry about mine. I find the most personal fulfillment in these multiple partner bonds. You can't tell me to settle for two-person bonds any more than you can tell a gay man to settle for a relationship with a woman. So I was quoting some of them and saying, I just don't know what the professor's response to this would be. And he got up. He was very upset about this. And he said, you know, these people that Sharif is quoting, they're fringe figures. Let me read to you some of their website data. This one does, you know, she'll read you your palms, and that one is, they're fringe. Nobody cares about them. They're not politically powerful. And I just got up and I said, could you imagine if I got up here and said, you know why I support opposite sex marriage? It's because these characters on the fringe, it's only 3% of the population. You would laugh me off the stage, and rightly so. It would be inciting your prejudice against a group of people rather than giving you an argument. You wouldn't accept that from me, don't accept it from him. That's the kind of argument you have to deal with because there are double standards, because your view is unpopular, so people can just appeal to the prejudices that are in the air. They can rely on their audience already kind of favoring them, giving them a handicap in the contest. And so that's a reason. One thing, it's just a reason to point it out, like I just did. Name it. Say, that's a double standard. You wouldn't accept that. Here's how you wouldn't accept it. And then clear the deck from there. It's also a reason to start on offense rather than defense. If you spend a whole conversation explaining why you're not a bigot, something went wrong. Okay, that's a rule of thumb. But one way to avoid getting into that awkwardly defensive posture is to begin on offense, not in tone, but in substance. Say, okay, I'll tell you what my vision of marriage is. I'll defend this whole big wall behind me, this long 2,000-year, 5,000-year tradition. I'll happily do that. But this isn't going to be just a context where I defend the whole wall and all you have to do is poke a hole in it. I want to know what your wall is, too. What's your big tapestry, your overall vision? You tell me that first, then we'll talk. Then it's apples and apples, right? I know you don't think it's opposite sex. What do you think the limits are? Why do you think they're there? There's a way, there's a mood you can get into where you see the other side kind of looks arbitrary itself. It looks like, well, okay, we're for public recognition of love, but only when the love is between two adults who are unrelated to each other, opposite or same sex, but it has to be a romantic relationship, presumptively permanent, kind of sexually exclusive, more or less. Why that list of characteristics? Why isn't that arbitrary? You tell me why you're there, and then I'll tell you why I have my vision of marriage. One thing that does is it gets them to see how hard it is to make arguments in this context at all. And that opens them up to your own answers. Because guess what? They don't have a good answer. That is an arbitrary list, given their own constraints on it. If you can get them in the mood where they're seeing that, they will be much more open to an affirmative argument that makes sense of most of the list, but also says marriage is opposite sex. Another thing to do, another way to start on offense, is to start with objections to their view. So I will address objections to my view at the end. You start with the problems for their own view. Then they're back on the market for an argument, for a view. You give them a positive proposal. You say, well, here's one that can make sense of our convictions and our intuitions about marriage. And then you say, and here are the answers to your objections to that vision. And you circle back to the objections to their view. That's the structure, I think, of an argument that doesn't make you on defense. And the last thing is you can turn their arguments against them in many ways. And that's what I started to do earlier with the loneliness argument. The idea that we need to extend marriage recognition because only in marriage can you find happiness. And I say, well, if we reinforce that idea by so extending it, we're only going to make people unhappier who aren't married. And no matter how expansive your marriage law is, there will be people who are unmarried. So you can question the very arguments they use can begin to work against them. You also absolutely have to start with common ground. The common ground might be shrinking in some quarters, and it's more expansive than in others, but pretty much everybody will have some common ground. So take, for example, the sex ethics arguments we talked about at the end of the first session. That's hard stuff to get across to people today. They are just baffled. I mean, they are honestly baffled by the idea that there could be any constraints on sex except for the ones that apply to everything. You know, don't lie, don't cheat, don't injure, don't deceive. But aside from that, how could sex have any more at stake morally than that? How could it require this very elaborate, oh, you have to be totally committed to them for life exclusively and so on? It's like, okay, let's leave aside that endpoint. Let me really test your idea that sex is no different from anything else. I don't think you really believe that. I think we have common ground, at least, that it's not. Why? Well, if I told you that I have a friend who plays pickup basketball every day at the gym, right? Every day at the gym, he just goes and whoever shows up, he plays basketball with. You would think that was a nice hobby. If I told you I have a friend who does the same thing with sex, he just shows up at the gym, and anywhere who's there and willing, he has sex with, you would immediately recoil. Why? I thought sex was just like any other activity. Don't injure, don't cheat, don't deceive. You think the stakes are higher for sex. You think coercion in sex is a much more serious violation of a person than coercion in any other part of life. You think freedom and love in the sexual realm matter more than they do in other areas. Why is that? I thought sex was just like anything else. So you begin with however small the common ground is. Like, well, other things equal, casual sex is worse than committed sex. And build from there. It's like, okay, well, why is that true? And what's the rational stopping point between that middle view and the full traditional teaching on sex and marriage? The other thing is that you have to understand their motivations. And one reason the conversations in this realm are so frustrating sometimes is that people aren't always clear about their motives. And so they will really be working out of one concern that will really motivate their view, but they'll give you a list of a whole bunch of other things that don't have anything to do with that. As I said earlier, you have to distinguish the rank and file from the advocates, the people with a very elaborate agenda. And most rank and file folks are motivated by the fear of loneliness on the marriage issue. They don't want to be lonely, they don't want their friends to be lonely, and they think that sexual companionship is the only answer to loneliness. If you don't realize that that's what's motivating most of them, and you entertain their arguments about, well, what about this case, what about that case, well, what about tax benefits, and so on, and you never get behind that to address their concern about loneliness, then you might have the very unusual experience, which my co-authors and I have had several times, of people saying, even at the end of a law school debate or something like that, you know what, you had a nice little cogent argument there, I don't even know where it goes wrong, I'm just sure it does. You answered all my objections, fine, but you're still wrong. It's because they weren't really worried about the objections they mentioned. They were worried about something else. And figuring out what their motives, what their deeper motivations are, is the best way of reaching them. And it's essential. I think all of this points to a different model from the domination model that it's very natural to have for a debate. You think you go in there, guns blazing, you show them who's boss, and they'll submit to the right view of marriage or whatever else. Of course, that doesn't work. But what does work? I think it's better to think in terms of a one-year plan I mean, just as a heuristic. Imagine that you are having this conversation not to get them to change their minds at the end of it, but to change their minds at the end of a year-long journey. What would that overriding goal look like? What would implementing it look like? What would you do differently? Well, for one thing, you would be very content to just plant some seeds because they'll have time to grow. You will be content to say, okay, just give me your objections and I'll just tell you how the answer goes on those. You don't have to believe it right here. I know it's going to take time to absorb it, think about it. I'm just telling you what it looks like. Plant seeds of doubt about their own view. You say, look, I understand the soulmate view. Obviously, a lot of us long for that kind of deep companionship. My nagging doubt about it that I just haven't been able to see any way out of is that it doesn't really explain all these other features of marriage. It's way too flexible. Companionship can and should come in all shapes and sizes. It doesn't have to be this permanently, exclusively committed thing connected to family life and so on. That's my doubt about your view. I mean, I know it has some appeal. Anyway, you just say it in that way, where it's clear you're not expecting an about-face. For one thing, because it's one of the most humbling things in the world to change your mind. It's deeply humbling. So not only should you avoid audiences for these conversations wherever you can, you should also avoid expecting them to change their minds on the spot in front of an audience of one. You should leave them free to make these very deep and personal changes in the privacy of their own home, so to speak. And one way of doing that, again, is having a much longer term plan. So you're going to answer their objections so that they can mull that over. You're going to plant seeds of doubt about their own view in a very gentle kind of way. And then you're on your own view, you're just going to give them a vision. It's like, look, if you plugged into this view, here's what you'd be going in for. Here's how all the different parts of it fit together. Hold off on a second on a particular objection to this or that part of it. Just look at how it all hangs together. This is the painting. These are the colors. This is the pattern in this different vision of sex and marriage and the human person. That's it. You'll have this ready to look at whenever you need to, whenever you're thinking more about the pros and cons of your own view. This will just be on offer. And if you ever need me to remind you of any part of it, let me know. I'm here for you. And you're not going to embarrass them. You're not going to use zingers. Because what does a zinger do? It ends the conversation. I'm not in principle against zingers. I don't have like a moral absolute against them. Sometimes I try to use them in a debate. But when I do, I know that I have given up on the argument, on the ideal of convincing that person. When you use a zinger, it's only because you're trying to reach a third party, to wake a third party up to what the other side is up to. So I'm not absolutely against them. But if you're in a conversation with someone you actually want to convince, zingers will have no place because they don't come back after a zinger. If you have a one-year plan, you're not going to use zingers. You're going to try to build credibility and trust with them. You're going to try to be the kind of person they are inclined to believe. We all know about confirmation bias, right? Basically, you start out with a view. Confirmation bias is the tendency we all have to ignore evidence that contradicts our view and take in and exaggerate evidence that supports it. And we do this with other people, too. We do it with what they're saying. We hear what we think they're going to say, not what they actually say. I experience this all the time in the marriage debate. So try to fight those motivations in the other person. Try to give them reason, if anything, to be inclined to give the most charitable reading to what you're saying, and to be most inclined to want to hear it and want to understand it and want to agree with it if they can. So what are we talking about? What is the context where you're not zinging, you're not embarrassing, you're not shaming, where you trust each other, where you're inclined to give the best spin to each other, you have charity about your motivations, charity about their ideas? What is that context? It's friendship. Is friendship. So I think ultimately the prime place for these conversations is friendship. The public debates, the law, the cultural stuff at the broad scale, the arguments, the books, all of that is preparatory work. It's just the material, the raw material for conversations among friends. That's where the action is. That's where they're most inspired to trust you, where they're most motivated to care about what you care about. They have reasons of love, even if they're not immediately motivated by the particular topic you're talking about. And it's where they're most motivated to give your statements and your motives the best interpretation. So that means a couple things. It could mean you befriend people first. That takes a long time. It could mean, and this is tough for all of us to hear, it could mean you start with your friends. It's a lot easier to have a conversation with a stranger about this stuff. It's a lot easier to throw bombs when you're talking to a stranger, and then you can just walk away from it. It's no skin off your back. It's harder to have it with friends, but it's also much more fruitful. And even if you're not having it with a friend, you can mimic the conditions of friendship. You can talk to them in the way that you would with a friend. Again, where if they ever came to agree, it would feel like they were doing something easy. They were joining you. You guys were both after the truth of the matter, and now you've both made progress towards it, rather than giving in, submitting, losing a match. You can create the conditions for friendship. Sometimes people are just too passionate, too Mediterranean, I can say that because I'm Egyptian, to have a civil conversation about these things. Then use letters. Write letters to each other. It gives you time to think things over. Nobody feels put on the spot. You can do it on your own time. And you are confronted with their words instead of the immediate passions of the moment. So you can mimic the conditions of friendship even where you don't have them. But the last thing is that you have to be building friendship even when you have these conversations with an acquaintance. And one way of doing that is to make it clear to the other person that your love and your interest in them are unconditional. That's the most important thing. They're not dependent on the other person coming around to the right view or joining your team. They're not. You're just their friend. And one thing friends do for each other is try to share good news with each other. And you think this stuff is good news. I had a friend from fourth grade on. So I guess we were about 9 years old. And we've been good friends ever since. And when we were 24, which unfortunately is about 6 years ago now, he shot me an email and he said, this is really hard for me to do. I thought long and hard about how to do this. I thought email might be the easiest. But I'm coming out. I'm gay. And even though I love the church very much, I really feel like I have to have a boyfriend and I want to have a family with a man. And so I'm going to pursue it. I don't know where this leaves my faith. I'm just letting you know. Of course, that's a very heady email to get. And it's really important how you respond. And I responded in email. I thought if he wanted to talk about it by email first, then it's only fair to respond by email. And I told him the things that you want to tell someone in that context, like, well, I love you no matter what. I'm sorry to hear that you're leaving the church or that you feel like you have to. I hope we can talk about this. But actually, the most important response, the most important moment in our friendship was not his email to me or my email back to him. It was the next 5 or 6 times we saw each other. I could sense it. He was waiting for a sign that I was withdrawing from the friendship, that I had written him off. The littlest things, the way I talked to him, the things I asked about, whether I was still as interested in his life as I was before. And that unconditional commitment is something we have to be experts at. No matter what people's views and no matter what their choices, we love them because of who and what they are, not because of what they do or what they think. And it's because of that love that we care about what they do and what they think. That's the most important thing. The cheer and the confidence, all that stuff about tone, that's just the most superficial signs of this most basic thing, which matters more than anything in the conversation. And where it's present, unconditional love, friendship, all the conditions are best for somebody to come around on something anyway. And where they're absent, then no amount of fancy footwork or rational arguments or statistics or studies or anything is going to have any impact at all, any lasting impact anyway. So those are some practical tips. I do think there's, of course, a Christian difference. It's going to look different when a Christian is doing it. So far, anybody could accept all of that stuff. Yeah, it's true. It's more effective to be friends. Okay, I'll talk to my friends about my views in liberalism or atheism or whatever. But this stuff is specific to Christianity. There's some methods and some motivations that are specific to the church. One is prayer and fasting. You have to have a supernatural vision about this stuff. You are not just fighting the culture. You're not just fighting a bad set of arguments. You're fighting principalities and powers. That's in the Bible too, right? But it's absolutely true, and we would be fools to miss it. Some demons only go out with prayer and fasting, our Lord said. We have to be able to pray and to fast out of love for people. If you don't have a supernatural vision about this stuff, you will burn out very quickly. I guarantee you that. You will burn out very quickly. And supernatural vision comes from supernatural means. And you have to turn the other cheek. That is also not something that's in the noble pagan handbook on arguments on tough issues. They will fight back. They will have a worldly vision of justice and fairness. They will try to hurt you professionally. They'll try to hurt you socially. And you cannot return it. You cannot return it. If you didn't have the supernatural vision, that'd be really hard to do. It'd be really hard not to think, look, Lord, I need to cut this corner to achieve the greater good. I need to tell this little lie. I need to punish this person, socially or otherwise, to advance the cause. It's for the greater good. That is a devil's justification. That is not something we're allowed to do. So their Christianity makes a difference. In some ways, it's a limiting difference. But in many ways, it's a motivating difference. I think one of the biggest reasons that you only find Christians on this side of these particular issues is not that you need Christianity to have these views, but that you need Christianity to keep them. You need Christianity to motivate them. If I just thought I was some lonely, random grad student fighting this difficult cause against the juggernaut, I'd lose energy very fast. But as it is, I'm a Christian, and I can see myself as a sort of pathetic, terrible end of this parade of saints and geniuses and heroes. You can read your Augustine or your Aquinas or your Dante. You can see the best art and the best literature all coming out of this broad vision of marriage and of family and of human beings and of natural law. That's motivating. You can watch A Man for All Seasons. I love that movie. It is, when I first saw that movie, I thought, I want to talk like him. It's about Thomas More, which is maybe his defense of marriage may be awkward to bring up by a Catholic and a Protestant audience. But if you think about the broader point, he was debonair. He was witty. He enjoyed himself. Why? Where did that joy come from? It's the joy of fighting for a cause that's bigger than you. Of fighting for this beautiful tradition with saints and heroes all throughout. Fighting at the end of this long and heroic line. You can take great solace in the fellowship of believers. Our natural state is not one of disagreement about these most important things. It's easy to get in the rut of thinking, oh, diversity, pluralism, values, oh, it's so great to be here. And it's true, there are great benefits to being around people who disagree with you. You get sharper on your arguments, on your ideas. You learn something. You undermine biases or prejudices against people who are different. All that stuff is great, but not as good as actually being of one heart and of one mind on the most important things. And you have to, for that reason, replenish your energy and your motivations in the body of believers, in the fellowship of the church, where we have a very imperfect but real reflection of the kind of unity we all hope for one day in the kingdom. You have a foretaste of that in the church. It's the reason Christ gave us a church and not just an individual relationship with him. He knows we need it, and you have to take advantage of it. The only reason I can go up in front of the Columbia Law School audience or the plainclothes police, whatever else, is that I have a deeply rich community of friends and relatives and fellow believers, the deepest kind of communion there is, to replenish my motivations. The other difference that Christianity makes, of course, is a bunch of advice about this. First of all, we have the Great Commission, and the lesson of the Great Commission is that it is possible to teach people all these things that I have taught you. It's very easy to hear the stuff about wrong side of history, wrong side of this or that. There's one wrong side of history. It's the side of the goats and not the sheep, okay? It's the wrong side of the Lord of history. And if in the meantime the Lord of history has given you a command, you know it's not in vain. That's a source of motivation. You think, no, history will partly depend on what we do, on how faithful we are in corresponding to grace, in responding to our own particular vocations. It also tells you that nothing is wasted. The noble pagan, at his or her best, has to believe that at the end of the day, I just have to count up my wins. I have to see how many people I recruited. And if it's a small number, or if the number fluctuates a lot from time to time, if I lose some people over time, then it was just a waste. For Christians, that's not true. You know that doing your vocation, being faithful, giving witness, even when it doesn't have immediate impact that's visible, has a long-term impact that matters very deeply. The spiritual impact, the fruit that it will bear for the kingdom, even in your own life before it bears fruit in anybody else's. Nothing is wasted. You should even rejoice about being persecuted. Imagine that. Fit that into a secular paradigm. You can't. So nothing is wasted for the Christian. And then, of course, there are supernatural goals. The worst goal to have in any of these conversations is just to win a fight, obviously. The noble pagan goal to have is to convince someone of an abstract truth. Maybe not just that, but at best to recruit them to a cause. But we know that it's not just about abstract truths, important as those are. It's not just about political or moral causes, important as those are. We know that every sliver of truth, however small, and every just cause, however large, is just a part of a much bigger cause, which is a relationship. At the end of the day, we know that truth is a person. He has a name. And the overriding goal that a Christian has at stake in every debate and in every argument and in every push is the natural thing, certainly, getting the truth across. That has value in itself. Serving the common good here and now, that's absolutely crucial. That's your way of building the raw material for the kingdom. But the broader goal is that kingdom, something that only God can introduce, and in which all of our efforts will somehow be taken up and find fruit. In the Lord, your work is not in vain, St. Paul tells us, and you will find it purified and transfigured through the fire in the life to come. That's why our Lord didn't say, you know, I've come to convince, I've come to rationally persuade, I've come to recruit for a cause. He said, I've come to set fire to the earth, and would that it were already ablaze. That's the cause that we have. And when you have that vision, when you have that eschatological sweep to your vision, to your goals, even for the most random and trivial conversation, even for the most apparently ineffective effort at bringing someone over to the truth on this or that aspect of these very difficult issues. When that's your overriding goal, it becomes much easier to do it with cheerful confidence and joy, to be fully honest, unafraid of any aspect of the truth, to be joyfully in the driver's seat, on the offense, not just on the defense, to cut your losses and realize, because they're not just losses, that everything is somehow for gain, for the good, to keep the motivations that all these great saints and heroes, these debonair figures in the service of the truth, have been able to keep. And to do all of it with love, with unconditional love, without even a temptation, either to cut corners or to premise your love for any particular person on their coming around, on anything. And if you have all of those things, the added bonus, of course, is that you'll be more effective. Thanks.